You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded New Calendar Christmas Eve 2024. Today I want to talk about, as we bring the year to a close, what will no doubt be the next arena of violence that the regime imposes on the world. You know, they're talking about the Iranian economy and her role in the Middle East and Central Asia. Has been a preoccupation of mine for some time. I've spoken a bit about why and how and to what extent the Iranian economy post-revolution has made extraordinary leaps and bounds. And it was a few years ago, I came across an article, and I don't remember how, because it was in Farsi, concerning the nature of resistance economics, which is an actual field, something imposed on the Iranian intellectuals, as well as the Islamic universe in Tehran, where economics is being upended, because this is a very different circumstance countries like Iran are working within. It's not merely sanctions, but mass murder of her scientists, nuclear or otherwise, the endless warmongering of the Zionist regime, not to mention the fact that the enemy, the Western world, is an oligarchy. It's not capitalist, it's an oligarchic system based on plutocracy. Most oligarchies are plutocracies. It's kind of hard to see any other version. Now, of course, the regime says the only reason that they have these absolutely inhumane sanctions on the Iranians is its nuclear program. And the implication is that this is for nuclear weapons. Well, given that one of the central goals of resistance economics in Iran is to eliminate their dependence on oil resources and oil incomes, especially abroad, the idea of nuclear energy is very obvious. This isn't about weaponry. It could be if they were forced into it, but I've mentioned this many times. I've also mentioned, given what's happened in Syria, which I haven't really stopped thinking about for some time, the idea is the destruction of these societies. This is your typical liberal Zionist mentality. This is very Judaic, so to speak. This is simply a part of that mind which they project onto everyone else. The purpose of the warfare to overthrow a legitimate government, a successful government, and reduce the society to warring clans like they did in Libya and pretty much everywhere else, is to destroy the economy and render the economy third world, or even worse. They tried to do that in Russia in the 1990s, almost succeeded, and the one very important place that they have failed in that regard is Iran. Clearly, now unless something drastic happens in Syria, they are the next target. Nuclear energy, of course, would be a huge coup for the Iranians, because then they wouldn't be, they could still benefit from oil, but they wouldn't be dependent on it. So I'm looking at this article. Now, this is a machine translation here. I obviously don't speak the language. But the title is A Comprehensive Definition of Resistance Economics. And this is an official publication because it comes out of the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance. More specifically, the Information Technology and Digital Media Development Center. And it was uttered in 2010. It comes straight from the Supreme Leader. But it didn't get put online, at least in this form, until 2014. But before I start, I want to mention the Iranian Constitution, specifically Article 44. The Iranian Constitution, the copy I have, is about 30 pages, and it covers pretty much everything, not just in terms of the state, but also in terms of the economy. Article 44 is the center of the economic elements of the Constitution. And I have to mention it because it's referenced many times. So let me read it directly. The economic system of the Islamic Republic of Iran is based on three sectors: state, cooperative, and private, and will be based on disciplined and correct planning. The state sector includes all national industries, foreign trade, major mines, banking, insurance, energy, dams, and large water irrigation networks, radio and television, post, telegraph and telephone, aviation, navigation roads, railroads, and other things which are publicly owned and under the state's control. The cooperative sector will include corporations and cooperative institutions of production and distribution that are established in accordance with Islamic criteria in cities and villages. The private sector is comprised of that sector of agriculture, animal husbandry, industry, trade, and services that complement the state and cooperative economic activities. The law of the Islamic Republic protects ownership in these three sectors so long as it agrees with the other principles described in this chapter, and it must not surpass the limits set by Islamic law. Such ownership must induce development and growth in the country's economy and not cause any social harm. The details of the regulations, areas, and boundaries of the three sectors will be determined by law. That's Article 44, and when you talk about resistance economics, I mean, there's other places in the Constitution. The goal of the economy, apart from the obvious, is self-sufficiency. Any rational state, any rational economy at this point, except for the very smallest, has to pursue some variation of autarky. The biggest problem with oil, and this is one of the reasons the Iranians want to get away from it, is that they have no control over the price. The price is set artificially, of course, by the major Western firms. I also want to mention, they talk about the cooperative sector. They don't give much detail here. And in general, what they refer to is something called the Bunyat, which literally means foundation. Now, they've existed for a while in Iran, but after 1979, the point of it was to redistribute income to poor families, and especially those who were killed in combat. And so they really came into their own during the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. And those, especially usury, and this is explicitly mentioned in the Constitution too, those foreign elements who have their property confiscated, it gets sent to these foundations. Today, they're quite large. There's about 100 of them, and they have, you know, smaller localized manifestations. They are tax exempt. They are subsidized. They are essentially religious institutions, and they're completely autonomous, something that the Constitution does not mention. They're involved in every kind of production you can imagine. The very large auto industry in Iran, they're a part of this. The largest one is the Foundation for the Oppressed and Disabled. Mostazafan, it's called. And they're in charge of quite a bit. They're a very, very large organization. About half of its profits, though, are redistributed to the needy and wherever they can be found. Usury is technically illegal, so they have zero interest loans, monthly pensions, and the rest goes to its own staff. Pretty much every Iranian town has some subsidiary of one of the large ones. And it's interesting how, while the West condemns these as just, you know, corrupt institutions, they have no idea how many employees they have. And one source says that they employ either 400,000 or 5 million. These are also very religious and ideological institutions. It's something that nationalists around the world should be talking about. They're even involved in trade abroad. And of course, to the West, it is outrageous. So that's what they're talking about when they say cooperative. The cooperative section of the economy, essentially the religious section of the economy, is very powerful. And they were powerful even prior to the revolution, and that's why it's mentioned explicitly in the Constitution. So the supreme leader in the various Islamic councils in Iran, over the last 10 years at least, have been talking about the resistance economy, keeping Iran prosperous, but keeping it also unaffected by their enemies. Again, this is something forced on them. North Korea has a similar kind of idea. They're talking about a resilient economy. It must, to quote the paper, it has to be able to resist any areas that might be exposed to the enemy's various conspiracies. The state, of course, has a huge role in this. Now, the cooperative sector is answerable only to the supreme leader. They're supposed to be very autonomous. They're almost like the answer to the Ford and Rockefeller Foundation. And really, in this paper, it's a certain translation of the supreme leader's speeches and discussions on these matters. And he talks about the successes and the failures and problems of this. Reducing the economy's vulnerability, but this also includes oil. You think this is, you know, their big ace in the hole. Well, it might be, but it has an upside and a downside. They even use the phrase, the tricks of the enemies. And we know who they're talking about. Not just sanctions, but everything from Soros, currency swaps and everything else. And the point is to use every bit of human resources that they can possibly, not just these people that they have access to, but also getting them in the right spot. He actually says, our citizens need to be given a field. Now, the Constitution guarantees the freedom of choosing your vocation. But the term vocation, especially the way I've been using it in the past, they mean quite literally. And of course, part of this is to go to war with corruption. This kind of resistance economy is impossible if corruption is on the rise. And we know that their punishments for this kind of thing are very harsh, and especially as the regime gets harder and harder against Iran, these punishments are going to get worse. Now, of course, protection, the rejection of free trade is built into this very system. Iran is a planned economy, but not in the same sense that the Soviet Union used to be. But part of this plan is the support for small and medium-sized businesses, cooperative and otherwise. The larger ones are fairly profitable, but, you know, cement, steel, this kind of thing, the defense industry. But real prosperity and real defense against outside tricks, as they say, is in the small and medium-sized units. the economic success of Iran, say over the last 10, since 2000, has been extraordinary. Keep in mind, Iran is a first world country, thanks to the revolution. It's a multi-party democracy. You know, it's a true Republican system in the best sense of the word. And its economy, despite everything, is doing better, certainly, than the U.S., and certainly better than Israel. And this is a few years old, but 14th in the world in the number of daily newspapers per capita published. And this is somewhat controversial, but depending on who you read, she is at the lowest, the 18th largest economy in the world, and about the 15th most rapidly growing economy. One of the highest life expectancies, the fourth highest government budget surplus, and the fourth highest in her current account balance. Again, this is a few years, this is prior to COVID. She's the eighth least indebted country on the planet. Gold reserves, as of a few years ago, the eighth largest in the world. Weirdly, Iran has the largest number of industrial robots in West and Central Asia. That would include Israel and Turkey. But given the dictates of the Constitution, Iran is one of the highest in the world in terms of wages, but wages as measured as a ratio against business expenses. So if industry lays out, you know, its expenses, and we see their total expenses over the course of a year, what percentage of that goes to workers? Well, any society that's very high on that accounting measure means that it has some of the best paid workers in the world relative to business outlays. And in Iran, it's about half. And part of that is it has one of the cheapest energy prices on the planet. Tehran is a very inexpensive city to live, and the subsidies are substantial. But the one thing, very important, Iran, as of a few years ago, was number one in the world in terms of industrial and scientific growth. And that comes from the annual Science Metrics Report that comes out of the UK. She has the ninth highest number of book titles published every year. Seventh in the number of scientific texts published every year. Third in university enrollments. And she does all of this with the so-called globalization index of 162 out of 181. In other words, of 181 countries that are measured, Iran is 162. In other words, one of the least globalized countries on the planet. So this conception of resistance economics has been a success. Any downturn over the last, say, 5 years is artificial. It's something that's imposed on them by the regime. It also goes to show that her scientific breakthroughs, she has a satellite in orbit, all this stuff, all under sanctions, proves that a strongly religious society and government and economic system also can be scientific in its economy. Iran is tremendously advanced in that regard. Over and over again, the book by Eric Archambault, who wrote 30 Years in Science, Secular Movements and Knowledge Creation, that was in 2010, says that the nuclear technology development program has really been the provocation for other areas of science. The growth index measure in this regard, Iran has progressed 11 times faster than the global average, twice as fast as Turkey, and 12 times faster than Israel. In this respect, over the last 3 decades, and this is strictly in terms of scientific advancement, faster than any other country, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And this is about publications, you know, among other things. Regardless of the weaknesses of that, it shows tremendous progress based on religious priorities. But it goes even further. I mean, students from the big Iranian universities are dominant, at least up until a few years ago, in international things like the International Science Olympics. They've won prizes all over the place. I know Bruce Woolley, who used to be the chair at the electrical engineering department at Stanford, says that Sharif University of Technology in Iran has one of the best undergraduate electrical engineering programs on the planet. Again, all of this under sanctions, among other things, not to mention, the occasional murder of its scientific elite. And by the way, these are native to Iran. The, Gulf Cooperation Council, for example, they utilize foreign, including some Iranian, scientists and engineers. Prior to 1979, prior to the notion of resistance economics, the industrial sector, in quotes, or manufacturing, was really focused on assembling foreign items, kind of like Mexico now. But that's not the case anymore. Iran has its own indigenous defense industry. They have their own line of jets, helicopters, drones, whatever. They're completely self-sufficient in that regard. Keep in mind, too, it's not just the sanctions, but 8 years of an imposed war with Iraq and the brain drain of some of its best people after the revolution and during that war, sanctions for almost three decades. Clearly, resistance economics has to be taken seriously. And it's not just countries. People like us have to be very concerned with our own financial situation relative to our resistance, which is why I need you guys so badly. It is Iran's policy of self-reliance. Dependency, and I've spoke of dependency at great length on this program and other places, dependency, almost by its very nature, is a barrier to industrial development. Now, people can be very lazy and say that, well, they have a lot of oil money, they could finance this stuff. Yeah, the problem is that other major oil exporting countries in the same region haven't been doing this. Industrial development, another big, at least in the Middle East, the Gulf countries, in these economies has been pretty negligible. Despite massive increases in revenues, they haven't really developed their own industrial infrastructure. They are also in a relationship of dependency. I remember a long time ago, I read out to you the people who were on the board of the so-called Saudi state oil firms. Every single one was educated in the U.S. They may have Arabic-sounding names, but they speak English at least as well as they speak Arabic. So Iran has been an exception. They've been an exception and exceptional in this regard. Now, I've spoken about what dependency is and how important it is, especially for the third world. When all the cards are held by the regime countries, or countries where the regime is dominant, it's very difficult to make any kind of progress if you're on the periphery, especially if the regime doesn't like you. Companies are very strict about their proprietary secrets, that the imperial powers have all the cards. They're exporting finished items, everything from cars to petrochemicals to pharmaceuticals. And what they're getting from the third world in return is unfinished products, resources. And any country outside of the regime that wants to break dependency will deal with color revolution, military intervention, and an absolute strangling of the economy. But if there's a huge debt relationship, then they have no chance of doing that anyway. Iran, because it has been under sanctions, and worse, been under the constant threat of military attack, that's created a in their planning system a way to break out of it. And in fact, it's been very successful. You know, technology dependence, where in the undeveloped world, in the third world, they're unable to master really the knowledge based on this. And what manufacturing exists is owned by foreigners. You know, exchanging manufactured goods for primary natural resources is always going to be in the favor of the finished good country. This is a huge part of the reason why Iran has to go. I mean, Israel is the main reason, of course. And of course, that's, you know, not to mention financial dependence. You have to borrow from financial institutions, which are the mainstay of the regime. I mean, yeah, the Western world is deindustrialized. The only thing it really has is what? Porn and banks. Any development project in the third world has to be financed by Western banks. Of course, today, that's no longer the case. That's why the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS and all this, and BRICS I'm iffy about. Remember the Venezuelans wanted to do the Bank of the South. This was to break that cycle of dependency. Places like South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, they broke out. I mean, we've spoken of General Chung Hee Park in South Korea. The U.S. hated him. The U.S. tilted to the North Koreans because he was breaking the ties of this dependency, issuing his own currency, the yuan, in secret, by the way. That was completely under the control of the state, which is why the CIA murdered him. I've spoken about that some time ago. Under the military, there was no American support here. But Iran is an exception. It's a strong evidence of the success of resistance economics, national socialism, in that it's a planned economy, but with plenty of private property, cooperative property, and of course a firmly religious nationalist identity. So that's, I don't know what else to call it. And their independent, self-reliant, autarkic economic development is a success. So it's a standing middle finger to the regime. This is a huge, at least an ideological reason, why it has to go. And in my book, The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failures of the Regime in the Islamic World, I talk about this at great length. There is a huge ideological part of this. Iran has pulled away from Israel in terms of scientific development and these kind of things. And of course, a typical response of liberalism and Zionism is to start killing them. The targeted assassination, how many now? 20, 30 of their top nuclear scientists and those in related fields. So again, whether we're talking about Russia, Belarus, or Iran, the sanctions have been, and it shows you the ignorance of the regime, the ignorance of the West, and it's been a huge blessing in disguise, I guess you can call it. However, part of the mentality of resistance economics, as the Ayatollahs have said, is to reduce dependency on oil and related fields. Now, there's a few other pillars. The Ayatollahs talked about consumption management. I'm looking at his speeches here now, that even the wealthy, it's actually, this is right in the Constitution, I should mention, extravagance is banned. It's wasteful. I have a whole paper out on how wasteful and irrational, inefficient capitalism is, because of all these ridiculous, these huge stadiums, movie budgets, all these resources that get siphoned off. And then, you know, and of course, this is also a society that rejects usury. Rather than charging interest, if you take a loan for, say, a major economic project, all you're doing is bringing in a partner. Payback is more whether the thing is successful or not, not simply the money. This isn't the mafia here. And the cooperative organizations are a big part of this too. It's no accident that the West wants to beam all of these ridiculous reality shows into Iran, which are banned, pornography, the Israelis the court of pornography, have been beaming them into Gaza and the occupied territories in general for a long time. You know, there's only one reason they're doing that. It's breaking this conception of self-sacrifice. Saving money, reducing consumption, rejecting extravagance for the sake of national goals. Well, only a national state can pull that off. Remember these campaigns during World War II, the U.S. was on the wrong side. And if you remember the campaigns to just watch your consumption, as far as I know, it worked. But it worked because America was a white country with a very specific identity. That's, you know, long gone now. But only these kind of societies can pull something like that off. So despite their brain drain, and that's a huge problem for anybody. Despite their brain drain, their knowledge-based sector is still doing very well, resisting the constant pressure of the enemy. Again, the U.S. doesn't get any oil from Iran. It doesn't get any oil at all from that part of the world. None of this has to do with that. It has, you know, as you know, the left tries to pretend that they're anti-war, but they're not, by saying this is all about oil, but the U.S. has no connection. Maybe they did years ago, but not anymore. The attack on corruption at all levels is extremely important. The rejection of all forms of waste, and it isn't like this is just some theoretical idea. This is being forced on them. So for the Iranians now, economics is a weapon. But that shouldn't surprise you, since economics has always been a weapon in the regime. Consumption management is a big deal, not just because it helps the resistance, but also in that it helps the economy and creates a healthy culture. Building entrepreneurship, that's long gone in the U.S. The Ayatollah in this paper talks about the demonic dominance of the regime, and its dominance is based on these huge centralized, whether it be banks or multinationals. So a country with resources, intelligence, high literacy, natural resources, strategic position, that has to go because the only ones who have a right to that are either the British or the Americans. Nuclear energy, of course, is just a pretext. The idiots talking about nuclear weapons, and of course, the minute they get them, they're apparently going to nuke New York City, they see that as a bad thing, and B, they think that they have any interest in doing that. The only aggressor has been the Zionists and the liberals. But, you know, on that site, I found a number of things in this regard, including the idea of planning. Let me clarify the notion of planning. There are many planned economies out there that aren't in the Stalinist or Maoist category. These aren't economic plans in that sense, where every aspect of production is, or investment, or even education, is planned out in advance. Now, that there's a certain logic here. Any country in Iran's position has to have a strong state sector. In Russia, Putin came to power and became very popular by realizing that they can't let these Jews connected to the U.S. and to the Israelis take over their oil fields. And that's exactly what was happening. ExxonMobil wanted all of these, and Putin wouldn't allow it. To these oligarchs, who didn't care, they'd sell off their mother if it benefited them, they had to go to prison. There's plenty of good reason to send them to prison, but the best reason is that they were going to destroy the country, to the extent they hadn't done so already. But the Iranian plans are a framework. These aren't specific. They're general. They're meant to be realistic. They have to be proportionate to the resources and goals that are reasonable at the time. I think they're at the 8th, 5-year, whatever it is now. And And one of the papers on this site that I, you know, speaks of currency. There's been endless attacks on the Iranian rial for a very long time. The loss of value, this is the one biggest issue in Iranian life, is inflation, interest rates, and the value of the currency. And the only way to deal with this kind of thing in the resistance mentality is rejecting the free market, having, of course, firm state control over the currency, and, of course, what we call import substitution. They used to have multiple exchange rates. I mean, they had all of these plans to try to get their hold of the currency. God knows what it would be under the market. The country would be colonized by now. Sanctions do not help matters. What also does help is that people aren't assuming that the dollar is a place to hide anymore. But inflation can really only develop in a vacuum. It can only occur when there isn't the production and hence the available product to sop up the excess money. There was an attempt in Iran prior to the sanctions, or at least prior to the you know, Obama sanctions, the huge attacks, and even Turkey. Turkey is in around 2000 to 2005. All of these, you know, opening to the world, all of these were disastrous. But when you have there doesn't seem to be a connection between monetary policy on the one hand and fiscal policy on the other. The only thing that's really saving them is that their debt is not very high. It really doesn't exist, although that's changing. And again, but that's because of exogenous factors, not because of any kind of policy. Import substitution simply means that they're going to subsidize the building of their own product that they normally would get from, let's say, the West. Now, of course, that's the death knell to any economy, because then that's what creates dependency. Of course, Western corporations can move in and undersell anybody, you know, fairly infant industries locally. And that's the point. American companies then colonize an entire area and then sell their very cheap product back to the Americans as a quote-unquote import. And these are the same people who are talking about, you know, they're totally against tariffs. But there's always good news on this front. The economic growth, scientific growth in Iran means that despite sometimes bad numbers, the currency crisis is not a deadly one. The very fact that you have an indigenous defense industry, you have a huge steel industry, the Iron and Steel Institute, International Iron and Steel Institute, has been very clear. And that region, huge region, Central Asia, Western Asia, all of these countries, Iran blows everybody away, including Turkey. The industrial oil and petrochemical sector, okay, you know, they have spin-offs. And this is the problem that the Ayatollahs talked about in resistance literature, is that, you know, the scientific establishment, as good as it is, still comes from, or at least came from, the petrochemical industry. There's a lot of spin-offs from that. And including the subsidies that other industries may get still come from oil exports. And now, of course, India has stepped in, and whatever they've lost through sanctions, they've gained. This is not something that Russia can help them with, although there's quite a bit of cooperation. You know, this huge automobile industry, 2008, see, once sanctions were put on, it's hard to get accurate figures. Iran produced just over 1 million cars. Turkey produced about 1.1 million in that same year. Iran now has the largest car portion of the car market in the Middle East. I think it's Saipa and Kodro. 2009, it was about 1.5 million. The domestic market, they have about 60% of this. But given their consumption management, you know, no one wants to see a Mercedes in the street. That's for Kosovo and Albanians to have, the Saudis to have. No, they want a what, you know, their equivalent of a Corolla. But the technological infrastructural breakthrough is far more important than the cars themselves. In fact, they even have plants abroad, specifically in Africa, Senegal, at least as of a few years ago. So to bring this to some kind of a conclusion, the real problem that Iran faces is the constant attacks on its currency. As far as I know, it's not a convertible currency. There's been many attempts to reform it, but the state still has to have a tight hand in it. Part of the problem is the up and down of oil prices. These, you know, typical exogenous issues. Sanctions did put a dent in the automobile, the automotive sector, because some of the parts did have to be imported. Much of that has been worked out already. Trying to make everything yourself, yes, in the long term has tremendous rewards, and they have the infrastructure for it, unlike the West. But in the short term, you know, you really can't plan to print money when you don't really know what's going to happen globally or even domestically. And that's not the fault of the Iranian state. It's something that the Ayatollah also said that, now I've rejected this thesis with the Russians. I've proven it using statistics, but a long time ago. But the Iranian government hates the idea that when oil is high, they start doing well. This is why nuclear energy was so critical to this, and why, and the Israelis are well aware of this. Now, of course, Iran has carved out its own market, especially in places like India and China and elsewhere. In the 1990s, Iran's GDP was averaging 10% growth a year with very low unemployment. Another factor in the currency issue is the American Depression, which started in 2008. Yeah, I mean, the, you know, inflation is high. It's not debilitatingly high. In the U.S., it's probably much higher than reported. Interest rates are, as of a couple of years ago, about 9%, which isn't bad for a younger, quickly developing country. But the best news is that oil accounts, I would say the last 10 years, for only about 50% of its economic growth. Domestically, it's about 18% of Iran's GDP. Of course, export, it's a huge kind of dependency. Resistance economics is to overcome this kind of thing and completely remake economics as a discipline, something that actually reflects the real world. The one thing that the Iranians are continuing to work out is the financial sector. Everything out, so long as the state remains strong, and so long as the media remains in state, religious, and national hands, and that's a critical idea, this will work. The regime is well aware of this. And it's right in the Constitution. The government has a responsibility to build a basically self-sufficient economy so that it can control prices rather than have it controlled by the global market or whatever mystifications for oligarchy the regime is using these days. But the result of resistance economics has been a highly literate, highly intelligent, and highly religious population. That's a standing mockery to the regime, to the U.S., and to the Israelis. And that's why we're guaranteed almost that a lot more of the scientific elite in Iran is going to be murdered. And of course, all that will be justified by the Jewish media. For those who celebrate on the new calendar, Merry Christmas, everyone. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.